You'll be sitting here going, yee-haw. Wow, 7-Up does that?
Okay.
Where you go, we show the inside of our edition.
Oh, I already showed
it. I did. I went and looked at it.
When was that? Today?
Yeah.
Yeah, she came over at 2.
Oh, gosh. You didn't get my message?
No, she did. She didn't go home.
I was at the post office.
Sorry, well,
okay, well, this is Laurel Tyrell, and I'm here with Bill and Colette Glanz at their home in Central. And so, you know, I'm specifically interested today in some information on the community of Central. But before we get going into the community, I just thought it'd be nice if you both said where you came from and how you arrived in Central.
Well, we came from Indiana, Northwest Indiana, outside Chicago. And my last few years on the department, they'd say, well, we can't give you guys any money, but however, we can sure give you some more leave time. So, so we had 60 to 90 days of annual leave every year. And so me and her would come up to Alaska in the summer, just drive around, see what we could find, and we drove everywhere we could in Alaska, except through the Hull Road. It wasn't open in time for us. And one day we came into Central here, and everybody was so daggone nice to us, and we went down the spring. My God, this is a great place. And we went back up to the Central. It was at the time called Crab's Corner, 1985. And so they were really nice to us, too. And then this one fellow come in, and he said he was a postman named James Carson. So he brought me a beer, and I brought him a beer, and me and him sat there trading beers for about an hour, and I said, guys, I got to go because I got to drive. And Carson said to me, well, why do you got to drive? I said, what do you mean, why I got to drive? I've had 3 beers. I'm not going to get caught and get the DUI out of state and everything. He said, we don't have any police. I said, wait a minute, you don't have any police? Huh. I worked 17 years in the ghetto and lost almost all of her good friends to murders and homicides and drive-bys. I says, you've got a new neighbor. And then we moved here for that. So that was 85. Then right. We went home that winter. And we got home about September, October. It took us about 6 months to get rid of all the stuff we had. Clay had semis with 42 tires on, 11 axle rings, and everything. So we had.
I hauled steel.
And she hauled iron out of this mills in Gary, Indiana, which is right next to Chicago. And she went from there to Grand Rapids and all those places there. And so we totally just retired and moved here.
Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois.
What's that?
I hauled.
Where you were hauling to?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. You took the road to Texas, too, one time.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you took the road to Texas. And, still going on?
Yeah, I think it's working.
Okay, so that's how we ended up in this community. And that was 1985, yeah. Jesus.
And when you first moved here, you lived up...
The first 2 years we lived here, we lived on Switch Creek, which is 12 miles out of Central here. And we lived in a big 3-room cabin where you almost need to be out every day cutting firewood to us, not insulated for winter. But we made through the first winter. Then the second winter, we brought property up on Portage Road. And it's exactly 2 miles from the Arctic Circle Hot Springs main gate. When you get 2 miles, you make a right, and it's another mile up this 4-wheeler snow machine trail. We lived there for 9 years.
Seven.
And then we was living there, that's when I went to work for the BLM, so they'd always send me away for 3 to 6 months a year. And Claire kept having trouble with bears, so I said, well, we got to move down here. So about the time we moved here, Laura Tyrell, a neighbor, she helped get a grant for
electricity.
And so when we got the power here, we moved in. We went from 1880 to the year 2000 in 2 days. We got power, we brought a dish for our TV, and now we got internet and all this kind of stuff.
It's funny. We had such a bear problem up there, and we moved down here. And what did I do? But shoot and kill a bear right out in my driveway.
So anyway, that's.
So when you said you were on Switch Creek, were you mining there, or
me and Jim Wild mined together. It was Jim Wild. I just worked percentage with Jim. He was all his equipment, his mine, and we did very well there. For believe it or not.
Yeah. I taught myself how to snowshoe up there.
And Jim had a look at mine, but Jim had so many other irons in the fire with his gravel bed and everything that just wasn't. I just left there and I went to work for the government. So I got in with the government. I enjoyed mine. I love mine. I just didn't like working all that damn heavy equipment all the time. You know, stuff that kill you, bust fingers. That's what turned me off of that.
So you worked for BLM that has a station here in Central. Yeah. Did you work in Central?
Yes, that's my first duty assignment was Central. Central here, we had, we had a complete mess hall with two cooks worked all the whole season, 6 months a year. And we had the upper Yukon zone was based in Central here. And then we had another big camp in Fort Yukon, and we had another big camp in Eagle, in our upper Yukon zone. And we also had Tanana, Bettles, and we had all the different areas there. And then, the Tanana Bettles was with the Tanana zone, but I mean, we may help maintain them in that. And I can't remember when they shut it down. And then Clint worked down there, Summers on Fires. And I think we closed it in 1994. That's when we closed the Central Station.
I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, and the Central Station was handed over to the Wild and Scenic River about 1996. And then in 2000, they closed Fort Yukon Station, except for emergency use. And that's right, 1992, 93, they shut down Eagle, so they shut down pretty much all the interior fire stations and moved everything to Fairbanks. And they're using them as a satellite. Eagle, they gave to Park Service. Park Service has Eagle or 40 Mile River. I don't know, one of those guys down south, down Tabor has that place. So.
Yeah, while he was working at the BLM, I worked at the Hot Springs.
Yeah, that club was mm-hmm.
I did
pool.
Mainly the pool. I did the pool for years. And then, there was one winter where I patched all the walls and painted the rooms in the hotel and the cabins. Sometimes I bartended, waitress.
Wait, I told a little bit of a lie, too. That's right. I worked at the Hot Springs from, 88 to 89, remember?
Yeah, 2 years.
Yeah, I worked 2 years.
Yeah, I'm a little Jackie of all trades.
I always like that phrase, Jackie of all trades.
I've always, my adulthood has been lived, it's been exciting and adventurous.
So you worked, what were the people you worked under at the Springs?
Well, first it was Frenchie.
Arlo.
Arlo
and Marie.
Yeah, Arlo and Marie.
Their last names.
Yeah, I can't remember their last names.
Well, Bob LaRue had it in 85 when he was here, and then in 86, Arlo and Marie took it over. I remember that. Bob LaRue got divorced from, I can't remember his wife's name now.
Loretta.
That's it, yeah.
Yes, he got divorced from Loretta, and Arlo and Marie took it over, and they were there till, maybe 89 or 89, somewhere there.
I'm not sure. I think it was 89 when Frenchie came in.
No, because I left her in 89. It was 87.
Okay.
From winter 87, Frenchie took it over.
That's right, okay.
Yeah, that was it, yeah.
Yeah. Fran Hoosman was my boss at the pool
started. Bob Harris was my boss when I first started. Yeah.
So the most of this was owned by Bobby Miller.
His pool manager he had hired, or how they worked it out. I myself, Arlo and Marie were the best thing that happened to this community when they were managing it. I mean, Bob LaRue was great, but I mean, I wasn't that familiar with Bob LaRue at the time. I know Arlo and Marie did. I mean, they supported the Quest. They supported us. They had big parties for the locals on Christmas and stuff. So they were an asset to me. I don't know what came down with him and Miller or whatever. But.
That Fran was funny.
It was Fran Hoosman the Moose Man. I used to call him.
I got to tell you an incident he did. It was in the middle of summer. It was so hot this day, and people were just lined up out of the pool house waiting to pay for their swims. Well, Fran didn't have any clean laundry, so he found one of those old waitress skirts, those blue denim things.
Oh, yeah.
And he, that was another one. This one, he was wearing his little bathing suit. That was it. He's wearing his little bathing suit. And so he got in line with everybody. So I knew something was going to happen that was going to be funny. So checking people in. Finally, Fran gets up to the desk. And I said, I need to see some ID. sir. And he turns around and he moons me and I stamp him. It's okay, sir. You're clear to go.
Yeah, I always call him Fran the Hoosman. Fran Hoosman the Mooseman, because there was some tourists there one day. And they wanted a set of antlers so bad, moose antlers. And so Fran free crawled up on the bar. He got the little set on the outside of the arm I'm talking about. He crawled up on the roof. And he somehow got the light bolts out of the antlers and gave them to him. And I said, my God. Be that drone to be up on a ladder? I don't think so.
Was this Fran the sheep herder or
something like that? Yeah,
he
was Bob LaRue's buddy.
Okay.
Yeah, those two were really good buddies.
Yeah, that's what they. So they came up. They actually take off together to go skiing down south once in a while together. Mm-hmm. So they were pretty tight buddies. They're nice.
And you also said that it was a really hot day and people were still lining up to swim at the pool.
Yeah.
Well, remember, it's hot water.
I know. They were there and they were in it. You know.
Oh, this was in the days when that hot springs was going great. People were parked out down the road. All of the parking lot was full of cars. And
they were turning people away. No, we don't have any rooms. I mean,
yeah.
Those good old days there. That's when, and like I tell you, because Clet was working the pool at $5 a head, and somehow they bring in $1,200,
$1,500
a day.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
For $5 a head, that's how many people wouldn't pass through there. No, you know, they were all camping around the area, and a lot of the miners and stuff like that. Of course, at the time here, we had 40, 50 children in the company. So you imagine how many adults we had that we hung out.
How I ever kept that pool clean.
Yeah, I don't know.
Was it because the price of gold was high?
No, this is when the gold was actually $4.50 an ounce, $3.50 to $4.50. But that's when, just the days prior to the EPA really crunching down on them heavy in the late 80s, early 90s. Because we had, me and Wal had a gal named Sue Wills. She still works for the BLM. She's my inspector, but she'd come out and just like I said, the good old days, she'd say, well, that looks close enough to 5 acres to me. You know, you had to have under 5 acres, otherwise she had to get disciplined. That's, and I mean, she'd come out and also the Dave Alaska had a mining inspector of some type. I can't remember his name or what a nice guy, but those two come around, they try to help you instead of trying to, oh, man, this is a $10,000 day. You got mud in the creek, you know, like they are nowadays. And like, well, unless we did, we had 3 ponds. We did everything we could to keep the water clean, but sometimes it would just be a little seep would go through the bedrock and end up going down the creek. Nothing, you know, nothing like a spring runoff, just kind of mud in the water. They could figure find 10 pitfalls on a day. And that was in the 80s. That's what the kibosh our communities here, I think. Of course, it's coming, even along with $1,200 an ounce, we still don't see an influx of miners. I mean, you know, $1,200 an ounce, my God. Some days when we mine, me and Wild pick up 12, 14 ounces of gold a day. You know, that's $12,000 a day. And I can't believe that they aren't. We've got the same ones here, Jack Henderson, Gordon Fulton. You know, I mean, the same every year, the Dean Willis. I can't, we got a lot of them. Well, we had two new ones last year, Chuck, I can't remember his last name. And Creighton Lapp, that's the only new ones I know in our area in the last 5 years that I know of. We've lost some more. But
So you don't think it has to do with the country being used up or anything?
No, I have the same feeling back here with Stevie Olson and his father Dave. Man, I can't imagine there's any gold left in these creeks after 100 years of mining, but they're still hitting. And like Wild says, you know, all this country they mined before, they used hydraulic and stuff like that. I'll make an example. One time me and Wild had to move, I'll say it's about, I don't know, 50 yards, 200 yards, whatever, gravel we had to move out because it was portal where we was working, it was fresh ground underneath it. So Jim said, well, let's just run it through the sluice box, we got to do it anyway. So we was getting an ounce of 100 just running the shit that they'd use horses and everything else and hydraulic off the hillside. We was getting an ounce of every 100 yards, I think Jim said. So, I mean, nowadays that'd be $1,000 an hour just doing that crap. You know?
Mm-hmm.
The ground is still a lot. Just like Jack Henderson, he's hitting, like he was telling me, he was hitting some of the hardest ground in the area right now up there where he's at. And just that canyon ain't as wide as my house parking lot here. I mean, just a little narrow canyon. He's going to Portage. So there's money in it. That's all I can think of.
Mm-hmm. What other kind of activities do you take part in? Snow machining.
Oh, of course, yeah, snow machine.
Oh, yeah.
Me and Clint used to put in the Yukon Quest Trail for years, and we just got tired of ruining our machines doing that, so now we just ride for fun.
Yeah, we called ourselves the Central Rump Rangers.
Yeah, yeah.
The Central Rump Ranger?
Yes, Sandy Crabb named us that. Yeah.
Anyway, so me and Clint, Jim Wiles, I hate to say names, I'll miss somebody, they're going to be mad, but there was, you know, me, Jim Wiles, Jack, I could go on and on. But anyway, we did that from the bottom of, what the hell was that, summit over there by behind the Angel Creek Lodge, I can't remember now.
Rosebud.
We did from the bottom of Rosebud Summit to Central. And from Central, we went out across the flats over to Eagle, Circle. And the Circle, the Central crew went to the Candy River, and we met the Eagle crew there. And some years, Jim and some of the guys would run all the way to Eagle with the trail in, but that was only occasional.
Oh. And that was never. Now, how many days did you end up spending doing this?
Probably 15, 20 days. That would be because we get to Candy River, we'd hang around there a couple of days and explore here and then run up down. Mark Richard and his wife, they lived up 50 miles up to Candy. We'd run up to visit with them like a day and come back that afternoon. Stuff like that. But as actual far as, I guesstimate, probably 6 days you could do the Quest Trail. I mean, put it in, come back, and then just before the race, run up there and remark it, make sure everything's good and come back. 6 days is probably. But in those days, we didn't get no reimbursement for anything. Everything we burned up was ours. And I burned up an Elan, a Tundra, an Alpine, and a Bearcat snow machine. So probably $30,000 worth of equipment put in Quest Trail. So, and I never got a penny for it. I mean, you know, so.
Well, yeah.
It sure does, you know.
I used to get on.
No, that's just my machine. I forgot about Clef. She burned up 2 Tundras.
Yeah.
And a Bear, and a Panther. And the Elan, that was it.
Yeah.
You didn't do much. No, you, that's those three you burned. Elan, you didn't do Quest Trail then. Yeah.
And I also got all the women in Central together, mm-hmm. and we get out there with our bow saws and willow snippers. And
cut trail.
Yeah, we cut trail from Hot Springs to Central.
Yeah. You guys went out to Medicine Lake, too.
Yeah, that's right. We went out to Medicine Lake that one year.
Her and Kathy Wass, Jan Foos.
Yeah,
there again, I hate naming names. We're going to forget somebody.
Right.
Joyce Stockbridge, yeah.
Yeah, Stockbridge. I remember when we were out there going to the Medicine Lake, there was this tree right across the trail. We caught a musher right in the neck. Mm-hmm. They come through there. So I couldn't quite reach it, so I stood up on top of my snow ghost seat, and I started sawing away. Babs was there, too.
That's right.
Yeah. Babs and Joyce says, well, we'll just go back and get one of the guys' chainsaws. And I says, well, by the time you do that, I'll have this down. I'm sawing, and next thing I know, I says, better help me with this. Hold it, because it's going to drop, and it's going to drop right on my snow machine if you don't hold it. So everybody brought their snow goes over and standing on them, and they were holding it, and I saw the rest of it, and we were laughing. That was funny. Says, God, that's they're teasing me about cutting trees down faster than a chainsaw.
And me and like to go out ice fishing and winter. We love winters just more than summers almost, I'd say. So.
How about subsistence activities?
Okay. Well, of course, we're like all subsistence users. And we hunt and fish, and we don't trap. It's the only thing we don't do, but we hunt and fish. We more or less stay within the federal laws rather than the state, because the state has only got like 30% of the ground around, or 78% of the ground around here is federal, so we're definitely in the federal assistance usage. And I've served now almost 6 years on the federal Eastern Interior Subsistence Board, and I've been chair of the Central Advisory Committee for the state of Alaska, I'm trying to think. Gosh. I'm thinking. 99, 98, somewhere there. I can't remember now. And we got on that. We started, Jim Wild was credited, well, I guess me and him and a few of us, but Jim was the main leader on getting us with an advisory committee on the state board again. We went to a federal subsistence board meeting. It was at the Hot Springs. I don't know what year it was. I just wish I had my, anyway. And so we were there, and me and Jim started hitting everybody. How do we get a game? Well, everybody's represented in the circle is our representative for on our board, but nobody in the circle ever went to any of the damn meetings. So meetings or even had any, they didn't even meet, they didn't do nothing. So they give us a seat on the state game board, and then Jim, he got appointed to the Federal Eastern Interior Subsistence Board through the Secretary of Interior, and then his hearing went so bad he couldn't do it, so then they appointed me to fill his seat, and I've just been staying there ever since. So I find that interesting. It's fun. Because you've said a lot, but it's fun. So.
That's right. We had used to have the Lions Club here, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were president, what, 4 years?
I don't know. You were president longer than me.
I think five years.
That's only because we missed the meetings.
I went to the meeting.
Yeah, I'm kidding, Clint. We got elected.
The reason I got elected was because, one of the guys, I forgot his name.
Clyde?
Yeah, Clyde.
The semi-blind guy with the...
Yeah, him. Yeah, he's an ex-cop from Florida. Mm-hmm. He got shot and...
Got blinded.
Yeah, he got blinded. But he spoke up during one of the meetings. We were voting for new officers. And he spoke up and says, well, how about a woman? And it was for the...
The Lions?
Yeah, for the Lions Club, or for the president. I did. I couldn't think of the word. For the president, he spoke up, and I go, uh-oh. And I got elected.
Yeah.
I was the only woman there.
Yeah. We had up to 25 members at one time in the Lions Club. That was our highest.
Yeah.
Because we had 25, and we was trying to get it where we get poll tabs. Not for us. I mean, not here in Central, but have somebody in Fairbanks, Klondike Inn. Somebody had one of our jars sitting there where we could get so much percent so we could have extra money. Because our Lions Club, we had thousands of dollars in there. Mostly it was just for community thing, Medivacs, whatever. And then used to raise a lot of money on the 4th of July, and then they put the anti-gambling bill on Tony Knowles, I believe, the government signed it, afraid the natives up there, being a tired reservation, was going to go into the gaming business. So they said, you can't have any open gaming at all within the state of Alaska. Anyway.
Right, that's when the Lions and the museum used to work together
get
lots of funds.
Then we started getting to the point where we had 25 members and 12 were paying dues, and so we had drawn out of our general fund, and then we down to like six. Me, Colette, Jim Well, and Al Cook, four, I think that's all it was. Four of us left. So we had a meeting in mind, let's just dissolve it. We dissolved the Lions Club here, Clett got $500 for the Children's Christmas Fund.
Yeah.
And the rest we gave to the museum. All the rest of the money and then we never gave to the museum. I can't remember how many it was. We could have $8. I don't know. It was $80. I don't remember now. But it was quite a sum.
But you've chaired that ever since, the Children's Christmas party.
When did you give that to her, though? You remember? I don't know if we've even living down here up on the hill. I can't remember now.
It's been a long time.
I'm trying to think.
I
did a couple years, and then I asked you if you'd do it, and you said yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing it ever since.
You've been doing it ever since, keeping lists going, and who gets what, and having a special child. And
every year she's done a good job on that.
Pretty bang-up job.
We think we're down to, trying to count.
Yeah, I have to go through mine.
I was just telling Laura, we had 44 children 1 year, and now we're going to be lucky to turn 12 this year.
Like, 1 year I had 44, and another year I had 46, and I said,
I didn't know
we had
that. I thought 44 was a
year. Yeah, it was like 2-3 years in a row where I had 40-some kids.
Now we're lucky to get that many adults in the community.
Yeah.
Right. I'd like to go back for a little bit. For a minute, we were talking about you doing the trails, etc. Are there any other trails in the area that you travel?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Well, make another story about the trails. Me and Claire, every year we put in the trails for the Yukon Flats School District. They meet here in Central, and they had the school Olympics.
The ski meet.
Ski meet. Upper Yukon, what do you call it? The Yukon Flats School District. So me and Claire, we put that trail in. As far as trails, me and Clint, we run the Beelenberg Trail up the Yukon River a few times, went up there and pulled out some friends' airplanes out of there. And what other trails? Oh my goodness, we run the Angel Creek all the time.
Oh yeah, the Angel Creek run.
And we go there.
That's fun. And we went to Dawson.
So that's a snow machine thing that goes on every year, Angel Creek run.
Angel Creek run, yeah.
That goes from here.
We leave here, go to Angel Creek.
That's on a Friday.
On a Friday. then everybody that works West Fairbanks in the North Pole, if they come back with us on a Saturday, we've had 70 or 80 machines doing that trick. And then Steve and Annette from Angel Creek Lodge, they're the ones that put it up.
And how about, you mentioned the Bielenberg Trail. Do you know, is that used quite a bit?
Well, James and Eve, what's James' last name? James and Linda. Basden.
Basden.
Yeah. James, yeah. He traps the Bielenberg Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns around Thanksgiving Creek. I may be wrong, Kevin. He goes quite a ways. And me and Clint, we could leave here on the Bielenberg Trail and be at Cold Creek, faster we could drive our car from here to Circle on that road and unload our snow machines and run down the Yukon River. I mean, plus we'd save 60 miles just traveling on the road with the car.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had that trail really well maintained. Me and Jim and Colette and Danny Cooper and all of us, we'd run that trail quite a bit. And we'd wash out, breakups. We'd build the big brush ramps to go up and down and cut snow and so we get through the big culverts up there. And that's one of the main trails we use for constant. It's still being used, but the brush is overgrown now. Nobody's really doing it. Me and Colette, we go up to the Portage or we'll go down to Bottom Dollar or something like that. But we'll make the round trip, leave here, go up to Portage, go down Portage, go into the upper mouth of Birch, and we get in the Birch, we run it down to the Bielenberg, you can take out and come back. We do that in the day run. That was a fun run. If there wasn't an overflow. The overflow was scary, so we've done that quite a bit. And I'm trying to think of some other trails. Of course, we use our snow machines a lot in the winter just to go to Central and back. Instead of trying to start a car, when you start a snow machine, it would not have been a problem.
Well,
cheaper too, huh?
We've been up to the rocks, too. We go on our snow goes.
Oh, catch some rocks, yeah. We do that with
some rocks.
Maybe going on four-wheelers and stuff, too, also.
And also, you were talking about your Central Advisory Committee. Do you know why? Weren't you instrumental in starting the Central Advisory Committee?
Yeah, me and Jim Wendell, actually. We're the ones that took the bull by the horns. And George Hiller has something.
Right.
Yeah, George is
and
office.
Jim Crabb, too.
No. That's about all it was, us three. And then we got Stan and Ed Galvin to get over to our side with it. I wish we had the paperwork for the first meeting we had where we elected officers. And I think our first election, we put Jim Wild chair. I was vice chair. And Ed Galvin was right below this. I can't remember what, as far as when we had something going on in Fairbanks, Ed or I would always go in because Ed was really wonderful there. The press loved him. Everybody knew him. And, I could talk for 30 minutes to the reporters and then go back to the room at night and watch TV, and Ed's on there for 10 minutes talking.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great. I don't care who got, but he was talking about the truth. Ed Galvin knew what the hell he was talking about. And then, I guess me and we were all instrumental trying to get to the damn thing there after we had that federal meeting. We got upset because we weren't being represented. We said, we'll take care of that. And it's worked out well for us, too, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
This year, me and some of the chairs from the 40 miles area, we was able to set the harvest. We was able to set the dates of opening and closing, and subsistence, how many they can have, and blah, blah, this and that. And the state game board says, "Dum, no problem. You guys know what you're doing." And they just went, they did. And I had the same opportunity with the federal game board. I go down the Yukon River, half site is on 25, I think it's D.
Right.
No, 25B. And you can shoot on the left side, you can't shoot on the right side. I said, so I want all our game laws here in 25C coinciding with the Yukon Charlie. And about 2 seconds later, Ruth Lundquist from the BLM got it and says, "We endorse it." I said, "Wow, that was a sneaker." And I said, "Wow, this is great." And the only one that fought us was the state, because they said we're going to deplete the resources. There, it's not just going to be any worse than it has been. But they're going to be rutting real hard in Sunrise. Yeah, that's why I wanted it, because I wanted to have more days of boating. So anyway, so that's we've got a lot of stuff done just by going to meetings and raising your voice a little bit, and everybody just starts listening and doing anything you want them to. That's quite amazing.
It's quite amazing, yeah. Yes. And part of the reason is because there's so many different managers on all the different lands we have here. So.
And collection there, with that being on the fire service, they have all kinds of fires around here. But she won't go out to a fire because the landlady said, "Oh, no, I'm not going to worry about this. Let it burn." You know, that's what happens.
But I do get sent out.
No, I'm not saying, but if it was like the days when I first went to work for the BLM, any tiny little smoke, they put a load of jumpers on it, and then we send the helicopters with buckets. And
yeah, they don't do that anymore.
Oh, they can't afford it.
Unless it's going to threaten somebody.
We got a phone call coming through.
Yep, that's what we get 10 times a day. Hmm. Lord, it's this. Boom. 10, 12 times a day.
Answering system.
Why?
You shouldn't do that because I'm on call.
There ain't no fires.
Well, there was no fire when I went in.
Yeah. So Colette is on call for the
BLM, Alaska Fire Service. Yeah, I'm a fuel specialist.
I'll turn back on it.
I fuel helicopters during the fires. I live and work out there in the field. That's quite a challenge.
So you would say that state and federal regulation has affected your subsistence activities?
It certainly has, yeah. Well, it's a lack of enforcement, too, in this area. Last year, when they allowed caribou hunters, the total take for our caribou 40-mile herd in 1 year is 850 animals. And that's 400-some in the fall hunt and 400-some after December 1st hunt or whenever it is they open, November 1st. Last year, they went out and they killed 1,200-some caribou and 800 cows. And they're trying to, they're trying to increase our herd at 40 mile, trying to build it up to the pre-1960 numbers, 100-some thousand. And that's written, I was raising so much hell about it. Everybody else wanted to keep the cow season open. And I said, the hell no, that's why we got to get rid of the cow season. And all the other boards, they went along with me, so I was quite shocked. Well, I had a couple of Fairbanks didn't want to do it. Oh, no, we want the cows. Said, no. And even the biologist said, oh, my God, no, is this because these 800 cows, they wouldn't have lived through the whole winter, and probably only 300 would have had a calf. Well, really? God, this sounds like 300 more caribou to me. So, I mean, the guy brought your plane from Tolk, the red plane. Can't remember his name.
Jeff Gross.
Jeff Gross, yeah.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned anything about your flying yet.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, let's see. When I was 16, I worked at this airport. I was trying to think of the municipal something. Can't remember the name of the airport. But anyway, I worked.
Too long ago.
Yeah, way too long ago. I worked for them, and every 3 hours I cut the lawn and painted hangars, whatever. They give me an hour of flight training. So I had about, by the time I was 18, I went into service, I probably had 30-some hours. So I went in to join the Army. You had to join them, because you're going to go to Vietnam either way, so you might as well go where you want to go. I went in to sign for the Army, and they said, in an application civilian skill, this is aircraft pilot. Even though I didn't have a pilot, or something, they didn't know what to check. I just put down, aircraft pilot. Aircraft don't matter if you got a student from it, or if you fly 10 hours, you're a pilot to me. And so I was going through basic training, they called me in the office, they said, would you be interested in going to helicopter flight school? Yeah. So I've been flying since I was 18 and all kinds of things. And I came home to service. I didn't fly for a lot of years. I was tired of flying. And this helicopter outfit called me and they said, will you be interested in being a flight instructor for us? That's why I'm not a flight instructor. And they said, well, come on out here and get you, how many hours you got? And I said, I don't know the time. I can't remember. They say I'm talking 2,300, 2,400 hours. And he said, oh, my God, just come out here and ride around a little bit and go take your written. So I went and took my written. I came back and I was a flight instructor. And anyway, so then we moved up here. We had a Cessna 172.
Oh, I learned to fly that.
Yeah, Clint learned how to fly that one. And so it was we had altered engine and all everything else like everybody does. And we sold that and I said, well, I guess I'm done flying. Well, it was 1987. Rob says, I'm selling my Champ, so I brought his Champ. And it's been set for a few years waiting on fabric because everybody's, you're next, Bill. You're the next one. We're going to fabric that sucker for you. You'll see. You're next on the list. I don't want to say the names of the four different ones, but I'm still sitting out in my yard without any fabric, and nobody called and come get it. So anyway, so last year I went and brought a Piper Tomahawk out of Springfield, Illinois. I flew down to visit. My daughters went down to Springfield, picked up the airplane, did an angle on it. I flew it about 10 hours around the pattern because I had to have 2 hours with dual instruction and ignoring my insurance cover. So I had 2 hours of duel, and then I flew it. And the last day I was ready to leave there, one of the guys said, I got to get down to St. Louis and pick up a vacuum pump. That's for my plane. I got to work Monday. I said, okay, jump in. So I gave him a ride down to St. Louis, picked up the vacuum pump, dropped him off, went to Chicago, visited my daughters, hang out there for a week. Flew there. From there, and I went across over to Northwest Illinois, picked him wild, and he came back to Alaska. He's been wanting to do that for 50 years. It was fun.
Also, have you ever used your airplane in your subsistence hunting activities?
No, I haven't.
So that year you went up the Colleen with Frenchie and Sykes.
When I was up in the Colleen, there's a story on that. Two of my buddy high school friends, they somehow they got my mail address from my daughters, and they wrote and said, we want to come go hunting. So that's what I was up there hunting.
Bob and Dick.
Bob, his father, he helped me in the Cadillac dealership, and Dick was the superintendent for the power company down in Chicago. Anyway, so that's why I was up there on the Colleen with those. So I flew those guys in there, and then Frenchie flew. I don't know what Frenchie, but Frenchie wasn't even involved with that too much. But he was flying back and forth with all the other paying customers. And then one day I had a moose down, and Frenchie came and picked it up. And that's when I told him, why don't you come back, and I'll pay you all these people out here. I don't have to, because, I mean, me and Robert shoving people for a bit. So Frenchie hauled everybody back, except Dennis Gordon, and he flew back with me. And I think I was the only one that got a moose that heard up there. Right there, I think. Wasn't I quite? Nobody else got one.
Don't remember.
Nobody else got
too
one.
Long ago.
Yeah, but that wouldn't even, I don't even think we even had subsistence at all. You know, because I had a regular hunting license. I mean, I think,
there was.
And I had a regular, we were,
depends on your definition.
We were subsistence hunting, rest for livelihood, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as far as, I had a valid game, to regular hunting license, like I've had since the first year I lived here, after the first year, and I've had a moose harvest ticket, and the issues of the state, but I mean, it was subsistence, yeah. I mean, me and Clyde ate on it. That's what I wanted to know.
But what you're saying is that the subsistence on federal ground has become known as the only subsistence hunting?
No, I wouldn't say that. That, you know, because when, not only federal ground, state ground. I mean, you know, so I'm figuring I'm fishing, I'm subsistence fishing, or, you know. And when I'm hunting on state ground, I'm subsistence hunting. I mean, in that sense, even last year, though, when there was 11 caribou harvested subsistence, because if you or I harvest one, we live in Central Eagle Circle, when you turn it in, you're actually, they're pushing that under subsistence. Even though we're starting on state ground, the state permit during the state season, I'll say November 10th or whatever it be. So, but there's still subsistence. I don't care how we do it. It's called subsistence to me.
What kind of fishing do you do?
Actually, man, Clint, we're not really in much in the salmon. We get 5 or 6 salmon from somebody every year, and that gets us. The main clip fish for grayling and northern pike, sheathfish, burbot. I can't remember what the hell was it. Whatever. We had every kind of fish we got in rivers we fish for.
Yes, sometimes we don't know what we're going to have for supper, and I'll say, well, let's go to McDonald's. And that means we grab our fishing poles and go to one of the local creeks and catch a fish each, and then we come home and eat our McDonald's.
She's frying potatoes, I'm out cleaning the fish. I bring it in, she throws it in the grease pan, and we're eating in about another 10 minutes.
Yep, that's the bush, it's McDonald's.
Yeah, I mean, that's subsistence to me. We do that quite often every summer.
Yeah, we're going to have to do that again.
Yeah, I was thinking about that thing yesterday. Too tired after all this crap up here.
Yeah, we've been kind of busy.
Yeah, you're building an addition to your house, which is about tripling the space, isn't it?
Yeah,
our house is 16 by 20 right now. And it's two-story A-frame, modified A-frame, so there's hardly any room there. We're building a 20 by 20 addition on the side of it. We're going to, where the kitchen table is, that's going to be the archway to get into it. We're going to have a real bedroom, and the upstairs is going to be a collection rec room.
Yeah, I told Laurel that. I still have a place to do my jigsaw puzzles.
How about stories of floods and things? Have you been here during floods?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
1989, my daughter Heather, my youngest daughter, come to spend summers. She was up here in summer 89, and she left At that time, me and Clint lived 2 miles above Portage, like I say, above the hot spring. And we was up there, and she came to visit. And Teresa was a good friend of hers. It was Belle and Gordon. It was Belle's daughter and Gordon's stepdaughter. Not really, they weren't married. But anyway, to make a long story short, that's who she lived with. So Heather went to visit Teresa, and she was gone for 3 days because all the bridges washed out between here and Central.
Yeah.
She couldn't get back.
We were stuck on that, this side of...
And the bridges, and they were stuck
over
there.
Yeah, everybody was stuck over there.
Yeah.
And all that huge water gushing through the hot springs.
Oh, yeah. It washed out the side of the hot springs.
Well,
years ago, there's a cold creek that comes out of, up above the hot springs. It's the one that runs by Frenchie's house. And it's a little brook, called a brook in the Lower 48. But this son of a gun was about 15, 20 feet wide, and it was coming down one side of the hot springs. And I can't believe it didn't wash out more of the hot springs than it did.
Yeah, it did wash something out.
Well, it washed out the whole hillside.
Yeah, that hillside.
It washed the Miller's junkyard got covered in. So, yeah.
That's right. Wasn't the BLM, that station was open then?
It was, yeah.
And people were, the BLM people were, got the canoes out, and they were floating around Central in their canoes.
Yeah, I remember that. That's before the bridge was washed. That's And then we had another flood.
Yeah.
Can't remember when that was. But I know that me and John Green had to get, but they called us back in for some fire duty somewhere. We was up here on our days off. And Mammoth Creek. We got up to it, and I said, whoa, I don't know. So we got out, you know, it was just washing on both ends of Mammoth Creek. So John grabbed my arm, and I stepped down. And I said, okay, it's only about that deep. And we ran across the bridge, and I stepped down. It was about, drove our truck across the bridge before it washed out. So we sat there and waited. It never did wash out. When we were there, we gave up waiting, and we had to be in anyway.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's it. Only two floods I've ever seen here, really.
Yeah, that year when it washed out at the hot springs.
Yeah.
And we had some angry tourists to deal with because they couldn't get out. Because, you know, they had to get back home and go back to work. Yeah, that's... Yeah, all of us employees had to deal with that.
With the road washing out.
Yeah.
So they couldn't get back to town?
Yeah.
Didn't that happen a lot in the winter, too, though?
Yes, it did. Matter of fact, one Thanksgiving. Oh, man. They were, for 4 days, nobody could get in. And here, I spent, it takes me two days to scrub the whole pool down in the winter time. And then the third day, I vacuumed the pool. And then I think it was the next day, it was Thanksgiving. I can't remember which day. I remember for 4 days, nobody could get in or out. And, oh, man, the kitchen, all those people, they made all this food. Everybody that worked in the kitchen, tons of food ready for Thanksgiving dinner. And no one came. They couldn't get in.
Because they couldn't get in.
Yeah, it was snowing really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, all us employees had Thanksgiving together. And then afterwards, Frenchie went out to, that's when him and Roberta were the managers. Frenchie went out to go plow the...
road or some parking lot something.
Yeah, the parking lot. And so after we ate... So, what are we going to do with all this food? And I said, I know. And I picked up this lemon meringue pie, and I go, and that started a food fight. That food fight carried from the kitchen all the way to the lobby. Oh, man, all that food. Yeah, we had a lot of fun. So we did something with that food because we were down in the dumps. We were. Nobody could make it in. And so that brightened us all up. So then we thought, uh-oh, Frenchie's going to be coming in pretty soon. And, man, we frantically cleaned everything up. All of us ran in and took another shower. And then we came back, opened the bar like nothing happened, and continued our party down there.
Yeah.
Frenchie never knew. Well, he might know by now.
I can't read.
But now you guys are caretakers over there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know when it closed?
Yes. Okay. It closed in 2002. that was the year it closed. Yeah. They closed it in 2002. Well, let me back up. It closed in 1989 to 1990, and Sue Natman leased it from Mr. Miller. And she had it till 97. And then Mr. Miller took it away from her because she wasn't making payments. And so then his wife, Laverna, went in, and she ran it to 2002. And I'm talking Miller's 92 at this date right now, 93 in 2010. Yeah. I think Laverna's 72, whatever. So they were getting too old to maintain it. Plus, he was upset with the state because they wanted to have 2 parts per million in the pool, chlorine. And it's not like a YMCA pool to change the water.
That was always a constant fight.
Yeah, it was. Anyway, so closed in 2002. In 2004, somebody named Larry
and Bonnie.
Larry and Bonnie. I don't remember their last name, but I'm sure somebody in here does.
They're from Ohio.
Mr. Miller knows it exactly. So yeah. They took it over and they ran it that summer. And they ran it about 3 weeks. And then the 2004 fire season, the biggest fire season in the state of Alaska started.
That's how I got my job with the BLM.
Yeah. Anyway, they ran out of personnel and they hired Clett. So the whole BLM rented the whole place for $3,000 a day. No, $4,000 a day. $4,000 a day. That's what it was, because I was part of that deal, knowing what it was and so forth. And they rented the whole place. And so nobody else would go on the property. Well, they could, but it was just the government employees only there. They had command centers set up. They had tents set up. They had fire camps sitting all over Central here. And Clint was working at the Central Airport for almost 2 months.
Yeah, I got all my training out there. Mike Silva called the house.
Yeah.
This is how I got the job. He was looking for Bill to rent our boat. And
I cannot rent. I'm a government employee. I can't rent anything to him. Years, about 93 or 94, Clett rented the Suburban to him to use, because there were no Suburbans, so they rented the Suburban to Clett's. And, oh my God, she had it online for, she made a couple grand on it. And when they got ready, they called me into the office. They says, we got a real problem here. What do you mean? It's nepotism, man. You work for the government, you rent the government equipment, are you out of your mind? And I said, no, my wife rented it. And so our office personnel, the finance person, what you got to do, you got to make sure you sign this oath that you and Claire are getting so you're separated. Otherwise, you're in a world of hurt. So me and her got separated that day for one day.
But anyways, Mike Silva and I were talking on the phone, and I asked him, just how bad is this fire? He says, it's bad. So I volunteered to work support. He says, I'll give you a call back in a few hours. A few hours later, he called me back and says, how would you like to be a fueler? I said, a fueler? What do they do? He says, they fuel helicopters. Do you want the job or not? I said, well, yeah, but I've never done it before. He said, don't worry about it. They'll make sure you learn it.
Carbon gas, you can fill them up.
Yeah. So, by golly, yeah, I didn't have no classes or nothing until I think it was 06 when I
started going to
hazmat classes. Now I go every year. But, yeah.
So anyway, that Mr. Miller, they rented out of Springs out, and it's Larry and Bonnie there. They got about $327,000. And I know for a fact I was involved with it. They called Mr. Miller and they says, what do you want to do with this check? It's $300,000. He said, well, give it to them. And, you know, they did all the work, and I'll get my percentage. Well, they got the $300,000 check and disappeared back to Ohio. So it had not been open since that date. No, and it never will be. It's totally gone.
Yeah, it's just too far gone now.
Yeah. And then last year, the state came in with some troopers and, fire marshals.
Fire marshals.
And they we allowed them into the building. They said we were growing drugs there. Well, come on in. So
that was funny.
There were no drugs. The troopers came up with they had all kinds of white trucks, and they had horse trailers on one.
Had the horse trailer.
Yeah, so they could haul their pot plants back. So they looked through it, and he said, well, maybe somebody else is growing, Bill. He said, I know you and Clay, but maybe somebody else is. And I said, hey, there's no power. Where can they grow? There's no power. The only place I got power, everything else, I cut the wires except for the lodge. That's the only place there's power going.
It was funny. I didn't know what was going on. You and Jose were in the back somewhere because you two were going to repair some pipes.
We were putting water back in the pool.
Yeah. And I was in the hotel and I saw these cars pulling up in that trooper car with the mini horse trailer on there. So I come out, and they wanted to see in the hotel. I'm sorry, it's closed. And we're not open. And they said, well, they would get a court order. That's why the trooper was there. Yeah, whatever. And I says, well, hang on a moment. My husband and Jose are in the back here. And we'll get them.
Wait a minute. Got a Mexican named Jose. Help. No, we're here.
So then I turned around. As soon as I turned around and started walking back to get these guys, man, whew, they had me all surrounded and escorted me back there, and I was kind of laughing. You know, what is going on? I had no idea it was a drug raid.
Yeah, and so then you said there was no drugs found.
Anyway, yeah, there was nothing there.
I gotta say, Jose's not Mexican. Jose's a Cuban.
Cuban, yeah.
But I mean, so if you say Jose, they think you got a Mexican out there, one of your field hair.
Goodness, he wasn't here when you said that. Oh, that was something. Yeah, they searched the place. There was nothing there.
Yeah.
And so, well, no one can stay overnight anymore.
Well, yeah, they wrote down that there's
two numerous violations. Yeah.
So they said the only ones that can stay there are Maine Coalettes.
Yeah, because, yeah, we know.
Believe me, we don't stay anywhere where we can't step out a window in that place.
Yeah, so, no further than the first floor.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the story of the hot springs there, unfortunately. And Mr. Miller, me and Clint, we deal with him quite often. And he's still stuck on this is worth $5 million. And we can Clint, Bernie Carl, I wasn't there. I don't know where I was at. But Clint and Bernie Carl and his lawyer and a banker, they all met with Miller trying to get him to come down to dump the place.
We tried.
We tried, yeah.
Well, we talked and talked to Miller.
Yeah, he ain't going to do it. So. It's going to hell now.